Okay, I wanted to talk about this morning, Asara B'Tevet, the fast day, which is this Sunday, and it's just one of those random days that I think for most people, just why? Like what's it doing there? And whether you're going to be fasting or not, it's still important for everyone. Meaning, we have the assumption that if we're fasting, then maybe the day might mean something to us. But if we're not fasting, then there's no concept of even thinking about what the day is. And I think the two are independent ideas. I mean, there's fasting, which is one way to manifest the fast day itself, one day a behavior, which allows us to express, or what Rav Soloveitchik calls nihuge avelut. There are certain actions that bring us to a certain state we're supposed to be in, but that's not, that doesn't undermine our awareness of what Asara B'Tevet is about, regardless of whether or not you're fasting. And I would like to shed light on it. Yes?
Can I just ask you, what time would be the fast? From when to when?
I don't know the time. I have to check the times. We'll put it in the email for sure. We're going to send it out in the email. But I don't know the times offhand. It's going to end early, that's for sure, because it's a short day. Yeah, it'll end early. So let me say that this shiur, I think, will perhaps shed light and lend some importance for our relationship to the day, again, regardless of whether or not you are fasting. Yes?
Okay, so because you said that twice, regardless of whether you're fasting
yes.
or not, are you insinuating that it's not...
All I'm insinuating is that I know that there are many people who do not fast. It's somehow developed as a Hasidic custom that has seeped into the modern Orthodox community as well, that women have a an easier dispensation with fasting for whatever reason. So I'm not commenting on a halachic level.
But I'm asking on a halachic level.
On a halachic level, ideally everyone should fast. Exclusion for pregnancy, exclusion for other medication and all that kind of stuff. The exclusions are very lenient, on this fast. But as far as whether one should fast or not, they should. Yes.
I won't be able to concentrate on ask this question now.
Sure. Let's get all the questions out ahead of time. Good. Yeah, go
for it. Is this a day you're not supposed to do anything like dangerous? Because I signed my husband up for NASCAR racing that day.
No.
I'm not serious.
The question of NASCAR racing is separate from Asara B'Tevet. It's a Shiloh any day of the year. I remember a YU Rosh Yeshiva got up in front of the Beis Medrash to speak about skiing for the entire yeshiva. NASCAR racing, Asara B'Tevet has no,
It's not like a day where you shouldn't do anything dangerous.
No. It's not like the month of Av. Which, by the way, is a great segue into the shiur, because one of the most profound questions is that we know that four fast days were established to commemorate the first destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Okay, four fast days around 586 BC were established. And the question is, why was this one thrown out into left field? Meaning, I understand Tisha B'Av, it's an Av, it's a bad month, no NASCAR racing. I understand why Shiva Asar B'Tammuz is already the beginning, getting us towards what's eventually going to befall us in the month of Av. And I understand Som Gedalia, which is part of Tshuva and recognizing our sins as we lead into Yom Kippur, going from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur. Fine. What's this one's like just middle of nowhere, just right there smack in the middle of Hanukkah. So before we begin this year, we're beginning this year, I want to just give you a couple random tidbits, which I think are you might find interesting, and that is in 1949, right? This is 1 year after the founding of the State of Israel. The Rabbanut got together in front of the Knesset in Israel and decided that Som Gedalia should be called Yom HaKadosh HaKlali, should be the general day of commemoration for the Shoah itself. And not Tisha B'Av. It was not initially Tisha B'Av. There was discussion whether or not there should be a day to commemorate the Shoah, should there be such a day, a separate day. And in a letter from Rav Unterman, who ended up becoming one of the chief rabbis, who was first the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv at the time, in 1949, right? He was the rabbi of Tel Aviv. He said, right after the war, we were not yet ready to discuss the implications of what had just happened. We weren't yet ready to discuss whether there should be a fast day, whether there should be events of commemoration. It was too raw, the experience, to even go there in our minds. But he said we're now 5 years later, and the question is now at the forefront of our minds. Should we establish a day that is a Yom Tzom for the Shoah itself? And this opened up a great big battle, which is not the topic for today, but it would be great for a Jewish history class. Maybe we could do it even once. Jewish history classes. The battle over what day, is there a day identified as Yom HaShoah? This was a battle that was between the left, the right, religious, irreligious, even within the secular. There was great debate as to whether there should be a day like this added into the calendar. But for a while in the history of the State of Israel, 1949, they decided that Tzom Gedalia should be the day to commemorate the Shoah, and it's called Yom HaKadosh HaKlali, the Holy General Day, where all these, you know, Kadosh is one who martyred themselves, someone who became a martyr. We're all martyrs for the Jewish people. All those who died are commemorated, are remembered, and that was 1949. It certainly since then has sort of waned as we either meshed it into a Tisha B'Av or into a Yom HaShoah separately, and Asar B'Tevet lost that extra element that it was given of being the day to commemorate the Shoah. But it was. There was an attempt to make it such. One more tidbit, and then we'll begin the shir, is this comes from Rav Herzog. Who is Rav Herzog? Rav Herzog got his doctorate in marine biology, and he was one of the great chief rabbis of Israel, a real unsung hero. He did so much great stuff. And if you look at a picture of him, he's the first chief rabbi of Israel once there was a state of Israel. He's the first chief rabbi to be a chief rabbi at the founding of a state of Israel, on the Ashkenazi camp. And he, if you see a picture of him before he became the chief rabbi, you see, you know, a student of halacha, a student of the world, someone who looked relatively young. And then you see a picture 10 years later, and you see he mamished age like 40 years in a short amount of time. And it makes sense, because you're dealing with someone who probably had one of the hardest rabbinic jobs in the history of humanity. To be the rabbi right at the period when everyone is trying to rebuild their families and come from the horrors of the war, and also couple that with the founding of a new state of Israel and all the implications and challenges that that's going to have, it's no wonder that this was one of the most stressful positions in the world. And Rav Herzog dealt with that, you know, dealt with that position very gracefully and as best as he could. So I found in one letter of his talking about establishing future fast days, Lezecher Yemei HaShoah, for the commemoration of the days of the Shoah itself. And are we allowed to add a date into the Jewish calendar? And that whole discussion, Rav Soloveitchik, you should know. Rav Soloveitchik, important to say because he was a modernist, Rav Soloveitchik was against adding Yom HaShoah separate from Tisha B'Av. His reasoning was that he thinks it undermines the weight of Tisha B'Av. Undermines the weight of the Shoah, not Tisha B'Av, the opposite. He says because Tisha B'Av has always been a day where we have our most intense mourning. And by giving it a separate day, Yom HaShoah, you actually won't take it as seriously. Because will everybody fast? Will everybody do all the practices they do on Tisha B'Av? They won't. So you're going to make a separate day, which will give you less attention on the Shoah. When in fact, as Rav Soloveitchik, you put it with Tisha B'Av, it'll actually swallow up everything else that's happened before in Tisha B'Av, and Tisha B'Av will become about the Shoah anyways. So he was a very strong proponent. Other Rabbanim of the modern Orthodox ilk felt, no, that if you don't have practices related to Yom HaShoah, it's going to be forgotten. It's like not having a Pesach Seder, you need to have practices, literal practices. Okay, it's a whole debate. Again, we could do a separate class just on that. But I bring you this letter from Rav Herzog because he's talking about whether you could add a separate day. And the Ramban is of the opinion that in general, we don't add more days to the calendar that we already have. And Rav Herzog says the fear is that you're adding things permanently to the calendar when we don't have the authority to nowadays. But he said the way things look, God willing, we should have the Mashiach come b'mheira b'yameinu, speedily in our times. And even if we add a day for Yom HaShoah, God willing, it will not last long. So it's not violating the Ramban, because people saw at this time, after the war, starting a state of Israel, the miracle of a state of Israel was so, it was unfathomable before there was a war. Certainly after the war, the concept of having a state of Israel was beyond anybody's mind. And therefore, Rav Herzog writes that it's no problem adding a Yom HaShoah, because the date's going to be gone soon anyways, because the Mashiach will be coming soon. That's what Rav Herzog wrote. So just a couple tidbits before we start the shir itself. Okay. How do we relate to Asar B'Tevet? How do we find any meaning in it whatsoever? And what should we be thinking about? So there was a scroll called Megillas Tanis, which we don't have anymore, which we know was alongside other scrolls, and it had in it different dates in which Jews were not allowed to fast on, for whatever reason. They were celebratory dates, so on and so forth, and days that Jews did fast on. It had everything in there. So it was a mix of a potpourri of Jewish law. One of the things we have in Megillas Tanis is as follows. It says like this. B'shmona b'teves nichtava ha-Torah yevanis. On the 8th of Tevet, the Torah was written into Greek. Bimei Talmei HaMelech, in the days of Ptolemy the king, V'choshech Bale Olam Shloshes Yamim, and darkness came into the world for 3 days. For 3 days. V'haya Yom Kasha LiYisrael Ki Yom Shenase Egel. This was a day as difficult for the Jewish people as the day of the Egel itself, worshipping the golden calf. So question number one, what's the big deal? Well, we're not allowed to translate. Art scroll, the day they made art scroll was the day like the golden calf. What's wrong? I thought we encouraged people to understand the text in their vernacular. They should know what's happening and what's going on. What's the problem? Yes?
What's the year?
The year when they translated it, I'm not sure which year. I'm not sure which year. We're talking about 200.
Okay.
200. So, B'shmona B'tevet Nichtavat was written into Greek. It was written into translated into Greek. So now, what's the problem with that?
So right after the Chashmonaim?
Yeah. So the question is, or soon after. So the question is why? What's the difference over here that's translated into Greek? We don't care about the vernacular. Like, it doesn't, like, that's never been an issue for us. And why is it like the Egel? That's question number one. Number two, the Taz writes, Ki beslichus shel asara beteves anu omrim shahatsarahi shemespo ezra hasofer. The aslicha, if you look at the slichas that you say when you daven asara beteves in the morning, there's special slichas you say in davening, it mentions that it was the death of Ezra hasofer. Ezra was the one who really revitalized Judaism as he brought the people back in the times of the second base of Migdash, and he really revitalized it, re-strengthened people's commitment to Judaism, and really he was one of the great heroes. I mean, after he's many times compared to the more modern Moshe Rabbeinu, Ezra was a powerhouse. And Ezra died on this day, and therefore that's why the sadness is. So the Taz says, where did the Megillas Tanis come up with this Greek thing? When it, the reason was because that's the day that Ezra died. Ezra died on that day. Number three, Medrash says as follows, that on Tisha B'Teves Nolad Oso Eish, that on the, just this is in passing, that according to some, that on the 10th of Teves, that person was born. Who's that person? That person, Oso Eish, is probably a reference to Jesus. Jesus was born on that day, according to one tradition. What?
He said he wasn't born on Christmas.
Said he wasn't.
He wrote a book about it.
Right, his book was on it. So yeah. Did he say Asar B'Tavis?
He didn't say when.
What day did he identify? So I just wanted to throw that one in. Now the Abudraham, who has a major commentary on the Siddur, says, Arba atzomos nidachim lifamim kishachalu b'Shabbos. All the four fast days usually are pushed aside when they fall on Shabbos, except for Asar B'Tavis. Now Asar B'Tavis can never fall on Shabbos, but the point is the same. His point is, were it to fall on Shabbos, you would not push it aside. Shiva Aser B'Tammuz, it falls on Shabbos, it will never override Shabbos. Never override Shabbos. This will override Shabbos if it were the case. So the question is as follows. How could Asar B'Tavis be more strict than Tisha B'Av? Tisha B'Av, right, gets pushed. If it's Shabbos, we move Tisha B'Av. How could Asar B'Tavis itself actually not get the override when it comes to Shabbos? That's the second way. So question number one is, what's the problem with the Greek thing? By the way, we have the Greek translation now. It's called the Septuagint. Septuagint is from 72 translations. The Septuagint is the translation of the, is referring to this Talmaic translation of the Bible itself. Number three. Why do we have the commemoration for a destruction? What's it really? If you ask someone in the street, what's Asar B'Tevet commemorating? Who knows? Basically somebody who knows a little bit. They'll tell you something to do with the Beis HaMikdash and the beginning of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And that's really what it is. Why are we commemorating the beginning? That's when they got through the walls of, they began their campaign against Yerushalayim. We have a Tisha B'Av already. We have Shiva Asar B'Tammuz. Enough. What is this? What is this about? This beginning to lay siege on Yerushalayim. So those are our questions. Let's review them again. Question number one is, what's the big deal with the Greek thing? Okay, why did they translate it into Greek? What do we care? Question number two is, I didn't call this number two before, but we'll put it as a separate question. Question number two is, why is that compared? Like when they brought the golden calf. It's as bad day as when they brought the golden calf. Number three, how come Asar B'Tavis potentially could actually be fasted on Shabbos while Tisha B'Av cannot? That's question number three. And question number four is, why do I need another one for the Beis HaMikdash? That's stuck all the way there in left field, all the way back by Tevet. What's it doing there over here? And not usually where we stack them in the month of Av, where we stick our Beis HaMikdash destruction days in the month of Av itself. Okay. So we know that Greek is considered by Chazal one of the most beautiful languages. It just looks like a beautifully written language. Old and classic Greek looks like a beautiful language. Torah, even the halacha even talks about the possibility of davening in Greek, if need be. There's such an idea. The idea is that Greek was the Greek language was a beautiful language. Now, is the problem maybe translating? I said nowadays we know we translate. We have Artsgor, everything. Rav Sajagon himself even started writing a translation on the Chumash. So what's the problem? So the Medrash Rabbah says as follows on the pasuk v'choshech al pnei tahom. Right? And darkness was on the face of the water. That's by the beginning of creation. Choshech al pnei tahom. The Medrash says, what's darkness? Choshech ze yavan. Darkness is Greece. That is darkness. Choshech zehu yavan. Choshech zehu yavan. What's Torah called? We know in Mishle, ki ner mitzvah v'torah or. Ner mitzvah and Torah is light. This Greek language, this ancient Greek language, not the same as what they have today. The ancient Greek language is considered, Yavan is considered Choshech. Torah is considered Or. So how are the two compatible? Greek was supposed to be a beautifully written language. It was you know, just a fantastic, as we said last week, Latein Yefla Elokim, that God gave beauty to Greece. If beauty was given to Greece, so what does it mean that there's this danger, it's Choshech, it's darkness? What does it mean there's darkness in the language itself while Torah is light? So I think the following is the distinction. Darkness, you could see everything in the dark. What do you mean you could see everything in the dark? You could see all the darkness. If you're standing in the dark room, there's no part of the darkness that you can't see, right? If you're standing in dark room and I ask you, can you see the darkness? You certainly can see the darkness. What can't you see in the dark? You cannot see the specifics in the dark. You can't make out necessarily what it is that you're holding in front of you, because all you see is darkness, right? What you see in the darkness is only the general. It's the klal. You can't see the specific in darkness. When you have or, when you have light, at that point, you're not looking at the totality, but you end up seeing specifics. You could see the watch, you could see the clock, you could see the painting, you could see the mirror. When a room is lit, you no longer talk about seeing, right? When someone says, when you're in a dark room, what do you see? I see darkness, right? They see darkness. When you're in a lit room, we don't usually refer to it as seeing light, because at that point, we see the specifics that are there present in the room itself. You understand the difference? When there's darkness, all you see is the darkness, and therefore there is nothing else to see. When you're in a lit room, you don't say, I see the light. When you're in a lit room, you then talk about the things that you specifically see. So when we compare Torah to Or, I think what that means, and Choshech to darkness, I think those references, and a lot has been said about what those references mean. Usually Choshech is confusion, it's evil. I don't think this is about evil and goodness. I don't think this is about good versus evil. This is about our perception of things. In the light, you can perceive all the details. In the darkness, all you see is the general. And the rest is you have to guess. In the rest, I stumbled on a manual, a Mossad manual, right? An outdated Mossad manual. I don't know if it was really, but, and it was interesting. You see the strategies that are employed for darkness. There's a whole section on darkness strategies. So, for example, listen to this. In darkness strategies, normally, one would suggest that you go to the wall of the room, the perimeter, because this way you could feel where you're going as you move around. So if you're in a dark room, you're supposed to go to the wall of the room. What was fascinating, though, was that if you're dealing in an intensive combat situation with people who are well-trained, they know this as well and will be at the wall also. Therefore, move to the center of the room. So what does this all tell you? So it tells you that in darkness, you have to rely on your own chachma, because you can't gain any chachma from that which you're seeing. You can't rely on anything which you're seeing, because all you see is the general darkness. With that being said, I support what I just said with the Ramban. Nachmanides says as follows: Ki hayevani asher hichish kol davar zulasi hamurgash lo. Vehigis data lichshav hu v'talmidav harishayim ki kol inyan shelo hisigelav hu besvaraso eino emes. The Greek philosophy was to look at the external. We talk a lot about the worship of the self, the worship of the body. We talk about, you know, it's hard when we talk about this whole story of Hanukkah and the Greeks. Everyone does this. We keep mixing different periods in Greek history. Like, oh, it's them with the idols. No, it's them with the philosophy stuff. And you have to understand, historically, there are different periods in the history of Greece. And you have to know what you're talking about specifically then. By the way, you know who we're talking about. In the story of Hanukkah, you're talking about in the land of Israel. In the land of Israel, these weren't Greeks who were sitting there studying philosophy. These were Greeks who were sent to conquer areas of land. So what are you talking about here? You're talking about brute soldiers. When we talk about the Greeks as a force for bad in the story, you're not really talking about them as having a philosophy which is antithetical to Judaism. You're not really talking about people sitting there reading books on the staircase, and you're not really talking about people worshiping idols. You're talking specifically about brute soldiers who just wanted to kill because they're conquering land. That really, if you think about who was there in the Hanukkah story. But that aside, the Ramban says the Greek ideology was to keep everything on the surface. Look at the outside. Look at the body. Look at the physical. That's darkness. Darkness says, I cannot see the specifics. I cannot look at the inside. I cannot look at the internal. It's a great piece from Rabbi Nachman of Breslov in Likutei Maran, his opening piece, where he talks about, we all try to glean from the light of the sun. Why? Why the light of the sun? Because the light of the sun sheds light in every area of our life to tell us to appreciate the specifics. Right? You know, when someone comes over and they appreciate something you did, they tell you, you know, I had a great time. Well, that doesn't mean nearly as much as when someone tells you something specific. I had a great time. I love the way you set this up. I love the way you did this, this, or that with your house. When someone is specific, they're bringing more light. They're shining a light, and that light is able to radiate because it sees details, it sees specifics. That's the difference between Choshech and Or, the difference between the two. So now the Maseches Sofrim, which is a mini Gemara, says as follows: V'hayom ze kasha liYisrael ki yom shenase ha'egel shelo yachlo ha'Torah li'targem kol tzarko. Why do we care that it was translated into Greek? We care that it was translated to Greek because Greek was such a beautiful language. That's why. Because Greek was such a beautiful language, you're looking only in one direction. You're looking at the letters. But there's no tochen. There's no inside. The words don't mean anything. If you take a word in Hebrew, you know that it's rich with meaning. For example, you take a word that says lev, right? The word lev. So we translate that as heart. But the heart doesn't mean, it's a wrong translation. I'll give you a better one. You know what? You tell someone sheker in Hebrew, false, right? Sheker. We translate sheker as false. That's a bad translation. You know why? Because if something is sheker means false, then it should never be allowed. It's just false. It's wrong. But we know we're allowed to lie for the sake of peace. Why are we allowed to lie for the sake of peace? So that people don't fight. We can create a lie. Why? Because sheker is not false. Sheker means something else, and it's untranslatable. If it would be false, it would never be allowed. Rather, sheker must mean something else. The best we could do is use an English word called false. But you have to realize it's coming short of what the word means. The entire Hebrew language is like that, the whole Chumash. That's why it's important to do the best you can in getting advancing or giving your kids the ability to advance in their knowledge of the Hebrew language so they're not always standing as an outsider. We're all outsiders. Most of us here, I could say, are outsiders to the text. Why? We're two steps removed. When we say the word, we go back to our mind and then try to translate it, and we work with that. As opposed to someone who's Israeli or someone who has a closer knowledge of the information, to them, lev means lev. It doesn't mean heart. It means lev. Ahava doesn't mean love. It means ahava. Take the word ahava, right? We translate it as love, but already you take away half of its meaning.
But does modern Hebrew really represent?
Right, that's the problem. Modern Hebrew might not represent, and someone will point to the fact that if you know modern Hebrew, you sometimes then have a misappropriated use of the word. There's been that claim. But ahava, for example, you take apart the word ahava, Rav Dessler says, is ani hav, I give. So already by translating, you've already taken away a little bit of the word. But we allow translation because we have no other option. You need people to have access to the text. But what Greek did, the Greek language, it was such a beautiful language. Everything was so externally beautiful that you took your mind off the prize. You stopped looking at the inside. And that was the great fear on that day of translating the Torah into Greek. When the Torah was translated into Yavani, it became something else entirely. And I'll give you an example of how it led to destruction. You want to know how it led to? I'll give you a specific example. Okay? One of the main tenets of Christianity is the concept of the virgin birth. It's one of the primary concepts of Christianity. You can't move without it. Okay? Where does it come from? You know where it comes from? The Hebrew word in the Torah, Na'ara, means young maiden. Nara means young maiden. When Nara was translated into Greek, the definition they chose for Nara, young maiden, was a word that could mean either virgin or it could mean a young woman, because it didn't have the specificity of Nara. Once it went from there over to Latin, they chose definition number two and not definition number one, and therefore before you know it, you've shaped history. And that's how the externals, by seeing the surface and the externals of the word, that's how you undermine the essence of what the Torah is about. It's with every word. It's rich. Maral says that every word in the Torah can give birth 1,000 times. A strong line from the Maral. There's so much that could come from every word of the Torah. So the fear was with Greek, specifically because it was so beautiful, it's choshech. All you'll see is the properties. You're not going to see the specific. You're not going to see the chachma that's behind it. Worshipping the golden calf was needing a physical external object to represent godliness. Moshe's late. He's not coming down. He told us he was going to be here. We quickly needed, instead of maybe thinking about there's a deeper reason, maybe the time we didn't understand, going beyond our surface feelings, instead we created a physical, beautiful manifestation of godliness here in this world. And that's the Chayta Egel. That's why the translation into the Greek is linked to the Chayta Egel. That's the connection between the two. Maimonides, the Rambam, wrote a letter to one of his faithful students, the one who translated most of the Rambam's works. Most of the Rambam that we have nowadays translated into Hebrew really came from someone by the name of Ibn Tibbon. Ibn Tibbon translated the Rambam. Rambam didn't write in Hebrew. Rambam was writing in either Aramaic or a more modernized form of Aramaic. And Ibn Tibbon translated. In a letter from the Rambam to Ibn Tibbon, he writes as follows. Kol mi shirotze lahatik milashen elashen viyachavin letargem amila achas milachas gamken. Whenever you want to translate something, because he's talking to Ibn Tibbon, why? Because Ibn Tibbon is his main translator, so he's having a discussion with him. So let me talk to you. You know, I'm going to give you the ground rules here before you translate my stuff. Whenever you translate one thing from one language to the other, yishmor gamken seder hamaimer veseder hadvar mitrach meot. Pay close attention to everything going on. It's not just, you know, when you put something into Google Translate. So Google Translate will get every word right. They're perfect. They're a computer. They'll get every word right, but they're completely wrong. Because when you speak a language, you have to take into account the fuller context. And Google Translate is not able to yet. It'll get there. It's not able to fully take into account the entire context. And that's why when you put something in, it comes out like, you know, really ludicrous. It comes out as a crazy statement. So the Rambam is saying to Ibn Tibbon, whenever you translate anything, I need you to see behind just what the words are saying. I need you to be learned, because you need to know what I'm getting at when you're translating a certain word into a different language. That's the chachma behind the way we speak. You know, it's so critical. When we speak to our, you know, we speak to children, we speak to each other. We're wondering what sets somebody off. You know, we're dealing with, let's say a partner, you know, or someone we work with. We're wondering, what did we say that just set you, what that made you upset? Or a kid, all of a sudden, they just got upset with you. What did I say? I didn't even say anything. What we don't realize when we're speaking is that certain words are triggers for other emotions and other feelings, because every word has behind it a certain chachma. And you don't realize that when you're saying word X and Y, with it comes a whole story of feelings, a whole story of emotions, a whole story of background that are tied into those words. And that's the potency of words. That's the or, that's the light, that's the chachma behind any vocabulary, is that it's so deep. Behind one way of phrasing something is all the difference in the world. You could change everything. Two people talking to each other, whether you create a rapport with someone or not. If you go back, there's a great book written by two Israeli psychologists. It's called, is it Click? I think it's called Click. It tries to analyze what makes people click and whether there are ways to synthetically accelerate a click between people. Okay, can you have such a concept or not? It's a crazy concept. So in their book, Click, the two brothers, Israeli psychologists, in their book Click, they argue the following, that one of the accelerations for a click in a relationship is a vocabulary rapport. right, is a certain rapport in the way we speak. If I have a certain lingo or style of speaking and it's matching the way you're speaking, then it accelerates a click between us. Even if we say differences attract, yes, they might be in just the way we act and everything, but if there's certain words that link the way we dialogue with each other, there could be an immediate click. That's one of the accelerators in a relationship. So that's because whenever you're speaking, whenever you're using a language, you have to understand there's so much behind the words you choose to use. There's so much behind the words, so much that is behind the meaning of those words. You may think you're saying something benign, but really behind what you're saying is years of therapy unraveling, you know, really coming undone. Okay. So
why is that fasting?
What?
So why is that?
How are we getting to Sarbate? We're not there yet. We'll get to the Sarbate. How much time we have? Okay. So so what we get at this first idea, that why is the translating of the language connected to this tragedy? Because by translating into Greek, we took people's eye off the depth of the Torah itself. That was partially part of the tragedy on that day. And it's about seeing the full picture. You know, Torah says, God says to Moshe, right, that Ureisa es acharaya p'nai lo yiro, you'll see my back, but you will not see my front. What does that mean? Rav Hirsch translates it as follows. You will not see my work, but you will see the traces of my work. If that doesn't help, I'll give you a mashal. You're driving on a road at night, and you keep swerving and swerving and swerving, and you're wondering, what crazy person designed the roads on this freeway that I'm going like this, I'm going like this, I'm going, what nut made this? All of a sudden, the sun comes up, and you realize there were mountains in the way, there were lakes in the way, there was a ditch in the way, and the road was planned beautifully and perfectly. That's Ureisa es acharai upanai lo yaro. You'll see my back, but not my front. You'll see the work in this world, but you may not see the fuller picture. And the Torah is about getting to the fuller picture. And having a Greek Torah is a fragmentation of Judaism, is a fragmentation of Judaism itself. Now let's move over to the next reason, the death of Ezra. The death of Ezra the Sofer, Ezra the Scribe, also one of the reasons for Tzom Gedaliah. So the Braisa says, Shebishnas Meloch Alexander, in the reign of Alexander, Pascha Hanavua, prophecy stopped. And the Gemara says, our last prophet is Malachi. Malachi Hayaha Navi HaAcharon. He was the last and final prophet. The Gemara Megillah says, who is Malachi? Who is Malachi? Malachi hu Ezra. Malachi is Ezra. Ezra, the one who brought the Jews back, who reinstated Judaism, reinvigorated them, that was Malachi. He was the last prophet in the world. What's the job of a prophet? The Navi is the one who sees behind nature. Navi is the one who sees the message that's beyond what's in front of you. The physical world can only tell us a certain amount of messages. The Navi's expertise is seeing behind that external. That's the same idea. That's Or. That's light. Light is allowing you to see more than just what is there on the surface. It's allowing you to see beyond that. It's like what we said a few weeks ago, right? You go into the flashlight store, and the question is, what kind of flashlight do you pick up? If you pick up the Da Vinci flashlight and shine it on your hand will look like a Da Vinci painting. If you pick up the science flashlight, your hand will look like a DNA helix. But if you pick up the light of Hanukkah, we said flashlight, and shine it on your hand, you see this radiating light that just, you know, is filled with information, filled with depth, filled with amkus. And that's the idea here. Ezra brought the people through his prophecy to a place they have never been before. He reinstated their connection back to Torah, to a deeper way of living, a more transcendent way of living. And because of it, it's the same idea. Translating the Torah into Greek was a loss of seeing the depth of the Torah. Losing Ezra was losing that ability to perceive beyond that which we see in front of us. Because Ezra was the last Navi. And with his death came our lack of being able to see beyond what's in front of us. We've had people who've been able to do miracles since then, but it's on a whole different level. The Gemara talks about a Chanina ben Dosa, a rabbi who ran out of oil for Shabbos, for his candles, so he turned his vinegar into oil. The problem was never miracles. By the way, there's a great book, Why the Jews Rejected Jesus. Why did the Jews reject Jesus? Why did they reject him? So one of the claims is because we could never accept the fact that somebody did miracles. You know what? That's not the reason. We have no problem with somebody being a miracle worker. You want to be a miracle worker? Be a miracle worker. That doesn't, you understand? That was never the issue for us. That was never the reason for us. We have plenty of people in the Gemara who did miracles day and night. Doesn't mean you're a God. It doesn't mean you're a Kadosh Baruch Hu. It just means you have a certain relationship to nature that other people don't have. That's why you see people, it's called a Wunder Rebbe, a Hasidic Rebbe who sometimes does things that you can't explain. They're called Wunder Rebbe, Wonder Rebbes. That's not the same thing as real Nevuah. Nevuah is gone. The ability to see beyond the wall, to see the depth of the world in that intense level, that left the world with Ezra HaSofer. That left the world with Ezra HaSofer. There's so much side points in each of these. Just one more I'll throw out there. The Rav Dessler talks about four levels. There's four levels of appreciating this world, and we always try to move ourselves from level four to level one. What's level four? Level four is where you explain every great thing that happens in your life. You explain it away by some rational way. Even if a miracle would happen right in front of you. It's why we don't have open miracles nowadays, says Rav Dessler. It's because we'd find a way to explain it away with science. There'd be no value to it. It's like, you know, it'd be a PBS documentary. How the 10 plagues in Egypt really happened. And you could explain anything away. You work hard enough, you could explain anything away in a rational sense. Who is it who said it? Herzl said, if you're a Jew who doesn't believe in miracles, you're not a realist. If you're a Jew who doesn't believe in miracles, you're not a realist. A fabulous line. Part of being a Jew, the realism of being a Jew is to believe that miracles could happen. So back to this. There's four levels of Amunah. The lowest level of Amunah is where you say, that happened because X, Y, and Z. The highest level of Amunah, where you realize that nature is just a smokescreen. There is no real nature. It's just a screen. It's an illusion. And once you realize it's an illusion, you could push right through it and manipulate it any way you want. That's how he was able to turn oil into vinegar. There's no nature. Teva means drowning. You sometimes drown out and lose the impact of what nature is all about. We strive to be at least at level 2 and 3. I don't know, any one-on-one? We try to be on levels 3. We'll take 3 or 2. That's where you end up appreciating God's hand in nature, in everything. And level 2 is where you mamish see, you know that God will do everything miraculous no matter what you do in life. Yes?
Is it like Hevel for number 1? Like from Qoheleth?
Meaning Hevel Havelim. The message of Hevel Havelim is ultimately that nothing means anything in our lives, that at the end of the day, we need to go back to basics. I don't know if the message of Hevel Havelim is ultimately the message that what you see in front of you is not.
I heard once someone in Israel was saying that it's everything is this steep. Like you said, this level one, that's the only reason I made the connection.
Oh, that everything is just Hevel in front of you, smoke screen in front of you. The word Hevel means smoke, smoke screen in front of you. Hevel is just steam. That's definitely a link as far as the name. There's also a connection from the Hevel Havelim to the Hevel at the beginning of the Torah, which is for another time. But the Torah is just an illusion, and we try to see through that. You want to look more into this topic, you can see the book World Mask by Rabbi Akiva Tatz. He's got plenty of it over there. Let's pull this together one more about the Tzom Asar B'Tevis, so we know what's going on. Now, we said Asar B'Tevis is about the death of Ezra the Sofer. We said it's also Asar B'Tevis is also about translating the what's called the Torah into Greek, the Septuagint, and part of it was about the Beis HaMikdash itself. What part of it was about the Beis HaMikdash itself? That it was beginning to breach the walls of Yerushalayim. Why Yerushalayim, and how does it connect to everything we're saying today? We know with Yerushalayim, Ki Mitzion Teitzei Torah. From Yerushalayim is going to come Torah. From Yerushalayim is the ability to perceive the world for its depth. When you stand Yerushalayim and you daven at the Kotel, you could see the world in a way that you can't say. I know there's one Wayu Rosh Yeshiva, who whenever he's up against the wall, has anything tough in his life, he will fly in literally just to go daven at the Kotel, get back on the plane, come right back home to give shir the next morning. Rav Goldberg will do it. Rav Goldberg will get on the plane, fly to the Kotel, daven, and come right back. Because Yerushalayim is the city of clarity. Ki Mitzion Teitzei Torah, Umidvar Hashem, and the word of Hashem comes out from Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim is clarity. That's where we illuminate and see the world for what it really is, to see behind the externals and to see the depth of it. That's the light. That's what Yerushalayim is. The connection of Yerushalayim and light we can go on at length, but it is the same theme. Yerushalayim, the death of Ezra, and also the idea of translating the Torah into Greek was the fear of moving to a superficial Judaism. Judaism that is all in the externals. My closing thought is as follows. Of all the fast days that we have, and by the way, just to answer why the fast. The fast, based on all this, gets you to remove your attachment to all the things external. Now, Judaism values externals as a value, but you also have to go inside. And for a day, we remove the externals, so to speak, which is eating, which is one of the most primary manifestations of the external, so we could just go back and focus on the internal side of things, its internal and intrinsic value. That's a concept of fasting, to remove yourself from the most physical thing you do for a brief period of time. Judaism does not believe in prolonged removal of the physical. Short amount of time, removal of the physical, so you could reorient yourself and refocus on that which you appreciate those things you have in your life. So let's bring it together. The point of Asara B'Tevet is a lesson that I think is so different than the rest of the days. The other days are tragedy. The other days are mourning. The other days have all of that. And there is tragedy on Asara B'Tevet. The Torah began to become diluted. We lost Ezra Sofer. Yerushalayim began to be sacked. But the concept of the day is something we all deal with, is replacing our Judaism with a superficial Judaism, where it's all about shtick, where it's all about the externals. I hear it all the time, this line about, but is it Hamish? Right? Now, I'm not denying there's a value to a certain feeling, an experiential part of Judaism, but define what you're referring to. What does that mean practically? Where is that in the Torah? Where is that in the halacha? Where is that in the observance? These things that we have placed as the number one value by which all of Judaism should be defined by, that is the triumphant value above all. Where is it? Where does it say that? And we've replaced our Judaism with I'll say this, it's recording, it's okay. We've replaced our Judaism sometimes with a bad episode of Seinfeld. And that's why people look at it and see it's all shtick. It's like it's become one big shtick, and we try to become more shticky than the other person in our observance of Judaism. And Asara B'Tevet says, stop! And go back to that which is authentic. Go back to that which is real. And what did God ask of you? Be good to each other. Be good to each other. Be loyal to God. Be faithful to each other. Be faithful to God and love other people. Those are the core. Those are the basics. God says 3 times in the Navi, I don't want you to have to bring your korban to the Beis HaMikdash. Stop beforehand and be good to each other. Don't hurt each other. Don't rebel. Just stay with the focus. Stay with the core. And that's what Asara B'Tevet is. It's not just an extra random day. We've given a certain power over Hanukkah to see the world in its depth. And Asara B'Tevet says, stop, and now use that Hanukkah flashlight. And that's why it comes right after Hanukkah. Use that flashlight to see the world and appreciate the world you're in, and go back to what really Judaism is truly about. Thank you. Thank you.